going to do what I told Tom I was doing, the five appetites of man, which very easily picked one of them. But then I want to cut that rather short, and I want to tell you what I think of Holden. And see if it's right. The five appetites that I've listed, and I suppose you can list others. Number one is security. Number two, prestige. Number three, sex. Number four, knowledge or wisdom. And number five, God. I thought if I wanted to get real analytical and Freudian, I could put death in there too, since the death wish is talked about at times. These five, I think, are elemental appetites or needs of man, and the first four are in a category a bit different from number five, the one for God. Security, the need for food and shelter and clothing, those elemental needs, there's no point ignoring them and saying that we're going to rise above them. Somebody has, you know, like Karl Marx, I think he'd say this is the elemental need. Economics is the basic study of man. A person has to eat. If he doesn't have food for 36 hours, he's hard to handle. This is what makes him tick. And he'll do anything for that. On this theory, wars are economic wars, virtually all of them. Wars to command the resources for food and clothing and these basic needs. And I suppose when you say what makes a person tick, what is it you want out of life, you'd have to put this down as one, that you'd like to have assurance that you could have food and clothing and shelter, and then you'd like to have assurance that you could have it tomorrow, and that your children could have it, and that your grandchildren could have it, and that your great-grandchildren could have it. So that security may be defined in a very restricted way, and on the other hand, it may go out of hand. I think we have, in our more or less affluent society, we've tended to define needs in ways that other societies never would have thought to define them. Implied in that is that since we have need of them, we deserve them too, no matter what, whether we can get them ourselves or depend on the government or whatever else, we deserve them. I was struck one night when we were looking at TV, and we were, the movie was interrupted by an ad that kept coming again and again on telling us of a flight, a special flight to Las Vegas. And the refrain that came, and it finally struck me, the refrain was this: you need it and you deserve it. Now this was about when it was 60 degrees below zero wind chill outside, so it wasn't hard to feel that you probably needed this warm interlude. And moreover, our neighbor had just taken off for Hawaii, and we're just as good as they are, so we deserved it too. But this refrain came coming again and again: you need it and you deserve it. And I thought at the time how distorted we have made this need of security, or whatever you call that. And I have a friend who's made quite a lot of money, but he's been very generous with his money. He's known how to let go. And he was commenting on what his friends felt they needed in order to retire. And he said each one of them feels that he needs at least 250,000, if not a half a million, to be able to continue the lifestyle that he's had. And he said, these fellows, when they get there, they don't say, well, now I've got a quarter of a million, I can start giving things away. They either increase the ante as they go along, or they decide to make sure that their children will get along. So they establish trust funds for them. And if they've got a lot of money, they build up trust funds for their grandchildren. The idea being that going to make for security. Now, obviously, there's some sense to that, but we ought to be able to, in our kind of society certainly, and the world over, there ought to be enough for food and clothing and shelter for everybody. But in our society, I think it runs a bit wild. And I must say that of these four, I also think that one or another tends finally to dominate. And you'd do anything to have this one thing. It's like the boy with a penny in the days when you could buy something with a penny, who came into a store with his one penny and stood before all these various assorted candies, trying to figure out what candy he would choose. He couldn't choose more than one. And somebody has said that life tends to zero in like that. And as the years go on, you're captured by one thing, and that becomes a controlling thing. And sometimes I get the feeling that people get captivated by however they define security. And of course, the fact of the matter is that inner security is never achieved that way. The fellow who has a million or two, he's far, far more frightened by looking at the stock market than I am, who don't own any stock. And so he has anxieties that I don't know about, simply because he's built up this phantom, really, of security. The second prestige is probably the most threatening of all of these, threatening in the sense that it can destroy you and dominate, because this is the one clearly competitive appetite you have. It isn't enough to have enough money, you must have more money than somebody else. It isn't enough to have enough power or prestige, you must have more than others. And we are competitive creatures. And the vice that enters at that point is pride. And pride is the queen of the sins, we're told. But think of how many people are disturbed by virtue of this matter of prestige or acceptance or power or whatever. I'm a competitive creature, and so are you. Now, I have no trouble applauding, cheering a football player on a Saturday afternoon. And whatever he does, I can approve, but if he's on the right side. But if a new preacher should come to town, and I've been around this town for 10, 15 years as a pastor, and somebody should say, well, have you heard the new preacher? He's the best preacher, I think, who ever came to this town. I have trouble applauding that. Because now he and I are in competition. And there are people who say that this is the basic thing about man, and that wars are political wars and not economic wars. You fight to save face and not for economic advantage. And this struck me forcibly during the Vietnam War, when the whole nation really wanted to extricate itself from that war. But we were told by the president that we were going to do it with honor. In other words, we were going to save face doing it. And so we kept on blundering along. And there are people who will sacrifice anything in order to have preeminence. And a person, let's say a lawyer or a doctor or somebody, or a businessman for that matter, who's making plenty of money. Let's say he's making $50,000 a year, and he can live on that very easily. But he's bothered no end that the doctor in the next office is making $75,000, or the lawyer in the next office is making $75,000, because somehow he's gotten the notion that that's a barometer of his preeminence or his value. Now, I think that's probably the most damaging of all the drives or the appetites we have, and the desire for preeminence or prestige or honor or acceptance or power or however you describe that, because it invariably it becomes a competitive quality. Now, I don't think the first one needs to become competitive. You're not competing with somebody else, because, and you're not troubled because somebody else has more money than you. You still want more money for the sake of money, for the sake of security that the money will give. The third one, sex, of course, is a tremendous drive, and it's quite easy in our day, going to some of the bookstores and looking at the titles, to conclude that that sex is by all odds the driving force in our society. And there are psychologists who will contend that everything else we do is in some form or another a sublimation of this one great drive. And I remember during World War II reading an article in Liberty magazine contending that if Hitler's sex life had been in good order, there would have been no World War II. Now, you can carry that and who knows? Who knows if he'd been happily married, he probably would have behaved. But it's hard to drive this into an absolute. But over public television now, there are 10 programs on Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, and I picked the book in the library and ran through it. I didn't read everything. I'd read it before, but I thought, well, I'll refresh myself in the event we get back to public television and see some of these chapters, so that I'm not haven't entirely forgotten the characters. But that's a rather striking book, I think, of sex becoming the dominant thing in the life of Anna Karenina. Now, I suppose you can there are other threads, but she gave up everything. All the other values became secondary to this one thing. And there have been people again and again who have thrown over everything, really, by being under the dominion of an uncontrolled sex drive. The fourth one, knowledge or meaning, fortunately, man has got that drive. And you think what's happened with it in these last 200 years, this explosion of knowledge. And if you find someone who is a pure scientist, as pure as he can be, he's not doing it for money, and he's not necessarily doing it to make the world better. He is in grim pursuit of knowledge. Now, fortunate for us, that's generally a good thing. I'd almost say that it's always a good thing, that God has placed in this universe all these resources, and he's given man this probing mind to find them, and so he must be pleased every time we do find something. And any advance in science or in knowledge, it seems to me, can't be attributed to the world of demons or to the evil of man. I'd rather put it on the side of the good and say that man's insatiable curiosity to find out about his universe and even about himself is a great boon to the human race. Now, of course, all the things that are found can be used wrongly, and I suppose you take the pressure to pursue the release of the atom as speeded up because we want it used to win a war. speeded up the process of the scientific discovery. And sometimes it isn't difficult for me to wish it had never been discovered. But by the same token, I can't say that I don't want to believe that this was a part of the evil that is present in our society, but that this release of the atomic energy and any other release of energy, any other discovery, properly used, can be a great boon to the human race. Now, I think that any or all of these can run off with you and take you captive. And probably the only salvation there is to get all four of them under the control of the fifth one, which is the child of God. The description of man as a fallen creature is that man is basically a chaos. Anarchy is the best description of the state of fall, of the fallen order. That it is without order and in possession of tremendous drives, unchecked, all of them destructive, but checked and properly used, becomes of great benefit to man. And if you describe man in these four categories, that he's got these four great appetites or drives, that he wants security, he's an eating animal, if you will, he wants preeminence, he's a fighting animal, he wants to mate, that is, he's a mating animal, and he's a rational animal, has the power of reason. But all of these are like powerful steeds. Unharnessed, they can carry you off into all kinds of destructive ways. And the only way that they can be harnessed is to have the person recovered for God. However, even if a person were to succeed, let's say, in all of these, become very wealthy, he had the wealth of a Rockefeller, and if he becomes very powerful, had the power of a Stalin or a Napoleon, and if his sex life, he were happily married, and this in complete control and balance, and if he had the, 20 PhDs, he could still be a very miserable person, because he has longings and yearnings that these horizontal things won't fulfill. He was created for God, and until he's back with God, he's a wild creature. He's basically a chaotic creature, driven by this and that, and with no essential order. But if he comes into fellowship with God, and if this becomes a controlling fact, then he becomes a servant. This is the key to his life with God, that he has his orientation is now to serve God and to serve his fellow men and to manage for God all these resources outside of himself and within himself. And like St. Augustine said, a person will be restless until he rests in God. And this restlessness is in fact a chaotic condition. And who knows when one or another of these appetites or drives may take over and run you over the cliff. Well, you've had this said many times in many ways, so I almost apologize for calling attention to it again, because I've done it under a different title on man here at the village before, And those of you who've been here before will recognize that. But it's been meaningful for me in looking at the human situation. And so I thought I'd rehearse it again. Now, I want to talk about the village. You know, Nora and I told Nora she'll have to talk to if she wants to. And the rest of you can, too. I think it was 1962 when we came first to the village. And we've come many times since. And we like the mountains, even though I suppose if I had to choose living in the mountains or living on the prairies, I'd live on the prairies. Because I grew up in the prairies. And I have a feeling of emancipation when I get to the prairies. But we love to come here, and not because of the mountains primarily, I don't think. This has become a kind of family for us, and I thought of it when we came up this time. Now, we had the good fortune to spend a half a day with Carol and Mary en route, so this was a part of the village visit for us. And then we knew Gertrude and Fitz were here. And those two couples are among our dearest friends, so that this has been a decisive thing, of course, for our visits to the village. But then there are these other people. Werner and Judy, we've known them many years too. Werner was at the seminary for a little while, so I knew him before he got attached out here. And then there are these familiar faces, Karen and Sieg, and of course John and Elise, and Paul and Carol, and Merrill and Bev have been here quite a few years, and Sieg, of course, and there's Raleigh and Keith, their faces are familiar. Don, were you here more than last year?
Yeah, same with John.
So we've had to look at you 2 years. And then Nancy and Tom and Therese. Therese been here only 1 year, I think. Yeah. And then there's Mike and Sharon, and it's just last year that Mike and Sharon were here, I think. Right? And also Tim and Sue. That just last year? Well, anyway, when we stepped out of the vehicle, and immediately we saw faces that we knew, and our hearts were warm. So it's been like coming back to a family. This continuity has been awfully good for us. I don't know what how many of you carry over now into the next regime, but and we don't know John and Mary, but know an awful lot of good things about them. So I don't think it'll be hard to make friends with them. But you see, we've had a remarkable advantage with Carol and Mary, whom we got to know well back in Iowa. We spent many evenings, late nights, visiting with them. And then Fritz and Gertrude, among the warmest friends we've got. So it's just been a lot of fun to come back home. I remember that first year when we were here in the fall, in September. It was the first year Carol took over, as I recall. And he thought there might be a group who would read Kierkegaard, The Works of Love. So he invited Nora and me out, The Great Deceiver. We did read a little, but he put us to work. And who should show up but another new face, Leo Bustad. So we had days together, and I don't think the staff was more than a half a dozen people other than the five of us. And Leo and Nora and Mary took over the kitchen, and I don't know what Carol did, but discovering my genius for washing floors, I I had to mop that big dining room floor two times while I was here, and took pride in that. But the thing that struck me was Carol's vision of what this ought to be. Until that time, of course, they'd been so busy putting some basic housekeeping things in order. And there was a Mr. Bird from Seattle who had done a great deal for the village. But Berg's interest was to get it in shape, and I think his idea was probably that it would be a good place for people to come and hike. And I'm not sure that he had much more in mind for it. And then Carol came with all these dreams that he has. You can slough off 90% of them and you've still got more dreams that you can handle. We all know Carol well enough so that we know that his idea that this ought to be a place where the gospel would find freedom and would roam the range uninhibited by anything but truth. And this is the direction it took, that one ought not to be afraid of theology or anything intellectual. One ought not to turn his back upon the arts, upon music and literature and everything else, and ought to relate it to culture, be a kind of microcosm of what the world ought to be outside. And that all through it, there ought to dominate a sense of joy. This, I suppose he came up with this term, holy hilarity. And I must say, I got a little weary of it once in a while, thinking that I had to force myself to be hilarious when I didn't feel it like that at all. But but basically, it was right. I like what C.S. Lewis says, that he said, your play and music and games and all of that, and the frivolous things that we call frivolous here, are the serious business of heaven. And joy is the serious business of heaven. And we ought to understand that when we try to have a touch of heaven here. Now, we haven't been here, I don't think, in the summer much. Once or twice, Nora? We've been here in May, and we've been here in September, and now we've had a touch of winter. So my observations, or our observations, of course, are touch and go. We haven't spent a great deal of time here. But I spent enough time to understand that while for us, coming in for 2 weeks or three or whatever, it is a kind of Shangri-La. But for you who are here the season around on the staff and in sustained study, it's obviously no retreat from the world, because you have an intensity in your proximity with one another that the world doesn't force upon anybody. Problems or feelings or issues that in this closed community may give you a little trouble can be diffused out there, and you don't have to come to terms with them. And I suppose this is one of the strengths of the village, and also one of the occasional pains of the village. And I think I can understand that a bit, even though I haven't spent a long period of time here. Another observation I've made is that since I think you've been succeeded pretty well in not having elitist groups, I suppose some of you sharp college people that are in courses of study may tend to look like that, but I've been cheered by the idea that work with the hands, taking care of the machinery and the roads and the cooking and the laundry and all these things that have to be done in the community, these are just as much a part of the holiness of the community as these lectures that some of these so-called VIPs may come around and give. And that meeting here tonight is, of course, I don't classify myself as a VIP because I don't have any specialties. So I'm, you know, a generalist. But I've liked that. And I don't know where else that occurs. It doesn't occur in a big parish where you've got a staff of preachers and secretaries and other workers, and then you've got a staff on the so-called janitorial staff who do all the hard work with their hands. Somehow this community speaks to the dignity of every task that needs to be done, and that the task is under God as much as opening your Bibles and trying to find out what Galatians says. I like that very much. I like the outreach that this place has. I think of it in three ways. One, the people who have been here and who are scattered throughout the country and the world, and who have caught something of this place and bring it out there. And the second, of course, and I haven't realized that until recently, the rather magnificent library of tapes that the village has assembled across the years. And I was astonished when Sieg told me how wide the distribution of them is. And that's a very significant thing. I grew up without tapes. We grew up with mimeographs. So it's only recently that I've even bothered with tapes. But I've sat here a few hours now, dabbling into this tape library and listening to these voices. Some of them I've known, and some of them I haven't known. And what an education a person could get if he simply sat for 12 hours a day and listened to those tapes for a month. You know, you have immense resources. Another thing that isn't noticed much, but I've been very glad for across the years, is your daily intercessions. And I'm sure if you people discovered that Nora and I had some tragedy occur in our family, we would be in your prayers. And not only people, but governments and culture and all of that. And while only a few of you may pause to engage in the overt exercise of intercession, it just thrills me to think that the intercessions are here day after day and covering such a vast waterfront. I think it's a great thing. Now, I suppose I've been sitting in on Bible studies and meeting with a group on them, the lifestyle, and now I've given these talks. And it dawned on me that maybe, just maybe, we talk too much about ourselves. I don't mean that we ignore the world out there, but we start to apply everything to ourselves and get a bit, maybe a bit too introspective, a kind of self-analysis. Now, I've had a little argument, been troubled a bit by this penchant for analysis, self-analysis all the time. Now, I grew up in a time when psychology was very primitive study, at least out in Augustana College where I started, and sociology too. There was one course in sociology, and as I recall, about one or two courses in psychology. I didn't take either one of them. I got some psychology later. But these two sciences, or these two disciplines that were subsumed for centuries under philosophy, and philosophy's chief interest was in metaphysics and ethics. Oh, some in epistemology, how do you know? But largely in the nature of things, and not so much zeroing in on oneself. And I think probably there's been a general danger in our whole society on that score. I have some awfully good friends like Fritz and Dr. Middleford, a psychiatrist, and others who are knowledgeable in these fields, and who make use of the tools well, because they've got qualities that and wisdom that enable them to use it. But I'm uneasy about too much self-examination. When I think of Socrates saying, "Know thyself," and Paul saying, "Examine yourself," I realize that they were asking us to examine ourselves over against a standard, moral or ethical standards, and see how do you measure up. Now, I think probably that's a rather strong strain, I would say, when we apply God's truth to ourselves here. But sometimes I think it would be refreshing if the village would get all excited about how many angels could stand on the head of a pin and get way out there and have a relief from too much looking at oneself. I remember Socrates one time saying, "I don't dare to examine myself too long, for I see there only a monster," which I suppose was another way of saying he knew all about original sin, even though he didn't know the term. But in MacDonald's little book, The Diary of an Old Soul, there's a prayer that I like, I think, better than any of the 365 verses. "Not, Lord, because I have done well or ill, not that my mind looks up to thee clear-eyed, not that it struggles in fast cerements tied, not that I need thee daily sorer still, not that I wretched wander from thy will, not now for any cause to thee I cry, but this, that thou art thou, and here am I." Not, Lord, because I have done well or ill, not that my mind looks up to thee clear-eyed, not that it struggles in fast cerements tied, not that I need thee daily sore or stole, not that I wretched wander from thy will, not now for any cause to thee I cry, but this, that thou art thou, and here am I. All self-analysis aside, I may not think I need you. I may be wandering from your will. I may not try to figure out whether I have done well or ill. I may not be probing to find anything about you. Not now for any cause to thee I cry, but this, that thou art thou, and here am I. You've got me on your hands, the way I am. Well, I kind of like that. And I think back of what happened in the Garden of Eden. Before the fall and after the fall, I've been pondering at times, what did it mean that they discovered they were naked after the fall? I asked Dr. Milton one time, Fritz, if my exegesis was all right, and he said, "It'll do." And here's what I did with it. I said, "Whom do I know who is not at all disturbed about being naked?" The only one I haven't been in any nudist colony, so I don't know about that, but a two-year-old child wouldn't be bothered. In fact, our son Peter's little girl was just about down the aisle, stark naked, in the midst of a sermon before her mother caught her. And of course, her mother would have been embarrassed to death, but Becky wouldn't have been embarrassed at all. Now, why wouldn't she be embarrassed? Because, in a sense, she had no self-consciousness yet. Her whole world was outside. You see a little baby playing with his toe? You're wondering what in the world that is. You know, it's outside. And gradually becomes self-conscious. So I said to myself, maybe before the fall, Adam and Eve were not self-conscious. They were lost in three great centers. They were lost in the greatness and goodness of God. They were aware of that. They were enthralled by the garden, the universe. They were enchanted by each other. Adam enchanted by Eve, and Eve by Adam. And then came the fall, and they turned on that, and they lost the three centers. They lost God, they ran away from him. They lost the garden, they were evicted. They lost each other in the grim outcome of Cain and Abel. Am I my brother's keeper? And that the long period of recovery is to, again, recover those centuries. Now, obviously, if I'm going to recover you and be of help to you, then there's some point in trying to discover what makes you up. And so the field of psychology and the field of sociology come into play, as do the other disciplines. But for the purpose, really, of serving one another and being kind of lost in the wonder of God, the universe, and each other. I think this is a very hospitable place. I can't think of any congregation that will take care of a stranger quite like you do. At the same time, a stranger coming here needs you very much. As hospitable people, so that to be on the alert when somebody comes into the village and hasn't been here before, that he's not just left adrift. Now, some of you do that as a matter of course, I know. Karen is busy with it again and again, and the rest of you do too. But it's probably a thing that can easily get lost, because what do we do when we come in to eat? We, of course, you know each other so well that no matter where you sit, you're sitting with somebody you know. But somebody who's strange and comes here probably needs an escort or needs somebody to, you know, ask questions about him, probe into him a little. I don't do that very well. Nora does it. She's always finding out who their grandparents were. And for the most part, people aren't offended by that. I've seen Nora do this in places where I thought she was, you know, wasting their time or holding them out for something, but you know, the outcome was absolutely, the guy thought, gee, I'm onto something. One of the finest members of our congregation in Ames, Iowa, told me, sometime later, he said, you know why I joined your church? Because of Nora. Well, I said, tell me about that. Well, he said, you may not remember, but I delivered American Express, a very ambitious young man. He had two jobs, American Express in the daytime, and at night he did bookkeeping for a warehouse. And he didn't belong to any church. And he said, I came to your house to deliver a package shortly after you arrived. And Nora met me at the door, and she said, why in the world would anybody send a small package like this, American Express? Why not send it parcel post? Well, he said, I got into a little argument with her on that one, but before I left, she'd found out my name and whether I was married and did I have a child and where did I come from and whatever else. And he said, practically everybody to whom I deliver a package won't even look me in the eye. I'm just a figure. And they'll sign for it and off I go. So he said, I joined your church because of Nora. And he was a great accession too, by the way. Well, these are some comments. Nora, have you got any criticism against the present regime?
Spoil any illusion they might have at this point.
And I wanted to get your reaction on some things that we talk about now. You know, sometimes it's distressing to think about the village becoming so big, institutionalized, sort of established. All those words, you know, it seems as though. Well, I think about, I heard stories about the first work crew that was here in 61. Sure, you know, you have experienced this in a real way. And I hear about how those, that group of people, in the first place, they paid to come here and work.
Mm-hmm.
And they got up at 5 o'clock and had Bible study, and then they had breakfast, and then they worked till noon like dogs, and then they went hiking to Image Lake and Heart Lake and who knows where. And seems as though they had a real sort of sense of mission, and it was an impossible task to get this place in shape. Impossible. And now we have a place that's in shape, you know. And I worry about getting sort of complacent or the fact that we might expect the village will do thus and thus and thus for us. And,
you have a comment to make on all that?
You know, we haven't made, so to speak.
No. It's much like a congregation that gets going. And in its first initial stages, everybody's working at so many things, and everybody knows each other, and then it prospers and becomes established, and they've got budgets and auditors and I don't know how you overcome that, except that you attempt to remember that the village belongs to you and needs you. And there's nobody, there's nobody on the staff that is not important. But oftentimes, when the need for this rather unusual exertion of commitment and energy and all that, when that diminishes, and you're always working to get it diminished, you know, you're in that trap too.
Bringing, focusing us and bringing our attention nobody stays here forever.
No.
I always think of it like a training camp. I mean, that's the only way I can understand people who call it a camp. I think, okay, it's a training camp. It's kind of like basic training. Mm-hmm. But it isn't, it's not a place to stay in that kind of a sense of, you know, well, we maintain ourselves here.
Yeah.
It's not the stuff we
Yeah, I think there are many subtle ways where that has to be kept alive without always having an orientation session. Now, this is what we're about. But enough of you, I think, have continuity in the village to know what it's about. And this becomes explicit at times and a great part of the time more or less implicit. A sort of air or atmosphere or contagion that's afoot.
But I think, as I understand what Karen is saying, how that sense of there's a real, you know, there's something that needs to be done and it draws us together. It's harder to feel that way about something that's implicit. You know what I mean? The subtle.
Yeah.
It's like the old war thing. The nation goes to war to bind itself together.
Yeah.
And as long as there's a war on, that we can recognize, well, you know, we're all together.
Yeah.
It's true, though. I think whenever I become aware of a person that's been here, and sometimes people come in with terrible troubles and you never know anything about it. Maybe not ever, but sometimes you find out after they left that they may have written back or maybe nobody knew what was coming.
No.
But it's true that whenever I become aware of a situation where a person has felt some renewal or maybe something, it does give me a renewed deal, if that's the word. I think this point is very well made, that that's what we're about.
I think you have to remember, though, Karen, that there may be people who come here who are troubled, who come here because nobody knows them here, and they're not going to tell you what the trouble is. The anonymity is what they want at the moment, and the healing may come without you ever knowing it.
And I also think it's true, sort of the opposite, is that when they are anonymous, it's much easier to unburden.
Yeah.
On a person you may never see again.
That's right.
And then that happens a lot, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Al, when you suggested the problem of self, did you mean personal selves or did you mean the village as a self?
No, I was talking about personal self. No, I wasn't talking about examining ourselves corporately. But that comes in too, just as Karen was indicating now. How do you look at yourself? And Elise was talking about that.
One thing Carol used to say that used to help me to stay in touch with our relationship to the rest of the world around us was if someone would say something kind about the village or what was going on here, and say if the small amount of light here looks so bright, mm-hmm. then think how dark it must be out there, you know. And it's sort of like, you know, it's a way to acknowledge both the need and give praise for what there is. And sort of, and then let it stop there.
Mm-hmm.
Neither complaining nor sort of getting sidetracked by it is, you know, trying to say, well, maybe this is what we'll do. Maybe this mm-hmm. is where we've really got to touch, you know. This is something we can do preeminently well.
Yeah.
But it may just be that we were chosen to do that at that particular time. And maybe we have to do it again.
Yeah.
Carol didn't say that.
I don't think you can throw in your chips and say you're through. I think it's just arriving.
I don't mean that, but I mean that we may, some particular thing may have happened, and we may be tempted to say, well, let's try to hold on to that, and let's try to maintain that. And I think even that might be okay to a point, but sometimes in trying to, we try to hold on too hard to something that we thought we had, it tends to slip away. Quiet, and suddenly you didn't there anymore.
Yeah.
And I thought when you talked about self-examination too, that you were speaking of the village as a whole, and not individual sin.
No, I was talking more about ourselves as individuals at that point. But I can't think of any. You know, we've got a lot of Bible camps and places of retreat around the church, but there, to my knowledge, there's none quite like this, and not just because of the spirit and the dream that that Carol had, but by a converging of a number of circumstances. You're at the same time as people come and go here, you have a sort of continuous community, a constant, enough of you.
Yeah, I have a real tendency to decide this is where we live, and we have a, you know, there, you have, that's one of the poorest places for privacy that I've ever lived in. And it actually really gets to me sometimes, and there are times when, especially in the long winters, that you pull in and pull your shades, and it's not out there.
Yeah.
And to be, I know we talked about it as a need for the people and for the whole community, why we need a congregation up here. Because
I think that things can happen in congregations that are not unlike what happens here. And this is, after all, an extension, in a sense, of the congregations of the church. And it's not just a place of experimentation. It's almost taking what the church has found good through the centuries and trying to zero in on it in a bit more intensive way than you can in the average, at least large, congregation. And yet it's happening in the congregations too. Well, these are rambling things, but And I mustn't forget what becomes very materialistic, the marvelous food that these exotic cooks are able to put together.
I get trapped a little bit back in one of the further things that was said, and I guess I found myself disagreeing a little bit, but there was a different spirit in 63. That's the year I had to talk about it. It was the first year I was here, but I was here all summer. And it was a great experience, and one that invited and tugged at urgent, well, the intervening years to keep coming back from time to time. And there was a certain excitement, because the village had sort of just been discovered. And it was beginning to take shape. But during this year that I have had a chance to see this village in operation, I have seen a degree of dedication on the part of informed kind of dedication and mature dedication, on the part of a very substantial part, most of the people having to do this work, that was not in existence in 63. And there was a sort of an excitement about something new that had some hope. It was the excitement of hope. But when we were here a few years after that, and then coming back in 69, and then again 2-3 years ago, and then a year ago last September, I've seen a constant deepening of the life in this village, a growth and a better understanding, perhaps, of purpose and of message. And unless I'm very badly mistaken, I'm terribly wrong, this place has grown. It is profited by the preaching of the word and the sacraments. It has been contributed to over all these years by this parade of people who have come through here in one capacity or another. Some of them just to receive, but in receiving have given by receiving. And others who have made enormous contributions, dedications to their lives. But if I were going to choose the attitudes or the strengths or the commitment of 1963 and the more recent years, I would take the more recent years by a long odds. I don't think we should overly romanticize the past. I find there's something, I think sometimes I feel almost indecent about a man getting old and being more excited about today than he was about yesterday. It isn't quite the thing that we ought to do. But the facts of the situation forced me to be more excited about today than about yesterday or birthday. And I don't think that's a different kind of a romantic or sentimental view either.
No, that's a great thing to hear, Fritz, because you've had a chance that we haven't had of a continuous feeling and observing of the village. And certainly I don't think in intermittent times we've come, we've felt that, my goodness, it's been regressing. Just been good.
That doesn't mean that every day is just as good as every other day.
No, my goodness. We're human beings, and there's a tempo that gets created. And somebody said, don't push it. Don't start singing before the conductor waves his baton. And there is something about that, too. That the Lord is around. Create some kind of rhythm in the lives of each, including the village. Well, thanks for letting us be a part of the village again for 2 weeks. It's been just great.